We are in the middle of a series, a sermon series, where every passage is leading us directly to the Lord's table. And I'm sure you can already see the correlation between today's text and this table, but we're going to draw it out a little bit further, and I actually want to read the text again, but before we do that, I want to pray. Lord, once again, we surrender ourselves at the foot of your word. And we pray that this story might awaken something within us. And pray, Holy Spirit, that you stir what you want to stir and shape what you want to shape. And all your people say, amen. So yes, 2 Samuel chapter 9, verses 1 through 13, which is the whole chapter. And it's an insert in the bulletin if you want to follow along this time. David asked, "Is there still anyone left in the house of Saul to whom I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and he was summoned to David. The king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "At your service." The king said, "Is there anyone remaining of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God?" Ziba said to the king, "There remains a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet." The king said to him, "Where is he?" Ziba said to the king, "He is in the house of Machir, son of Emiel, at Lodabar." Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, son of Emiel, at Lodabar. Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and did obeisance. David said, "Mephibosheth." He answered, "I am your servant." David said to him, "Do not be afraid, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father, Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land of your grandfather, Saul, and you yourself shall eat at my table always." He did obeisance and said, "What is your servant that you should look upon a dead dog such as I?" Then the king summoned Saul's servant Ziba and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. You and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce so that your master's grandson may have food to eat. But your master's grandson Mephibosheth shall always eat at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so your servant will do." Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah, and all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he always ate at the king's table. Now, he was lame in both his feet. Brothers and sisters, this is the word of the Lord. So say this with me, Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth. It's not an easy word. Kind of a little bit of a silent E, a little bit of a silent O, Mephibosheth, but you could say, but Mephibosheth. I think this is a story that you want to share and share often, so it helps to be able to say the name correctly. It's a tough name, and it's so easy to pronounce it, Mephibosheth, and all sorts of other things, isn't it? Mephibosheth, Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth was introduced a couple of chapters earlier. If you read along in 2 Samuel, you would have encountered him a couple chapters earlier, almost as an aside to this story about Ishbal's assassination. And so this is what it says in chapter 4, verse 4. Saul's son Jonathan had a son who was crippled in his feet. And then it explains how that came to be. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, namely that they had suffered defeat at the hands of the Philistines. And so his nurse picked him up and fled. And in her haste to flee, it happened that he fell and became lame. His name was Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth was lame, and not the sort of colloquialism that we've got now that kind of means not cool. He was lame as in unable to walk. His feet were ruined when his nurse, kind of like his nanny, dropped him in her panicked escape, knowing that she too could be defeated by these same people that defeated Saul and Jonathan. And Mephibosheth was 5 years old at the time, and he would never be able to walk again. And as best we can tell, he lived most of the rest of his life, up until this story, in relative obscurity, even though he was a descendant of the former king. And that's what we know about him based on a single verse of introduction a couple chapters earlier. That's what we know. And one other thing. His name itself, that last line, his name was Mephibosheth. That tells us something about him too, because he was originally named Meribaal, which means exterminating idols, the idols of Baal, B-A-A-L, B-A-A-L. And then he grew to have this other name, maybe a nickname, maybe something given to him later in life, Mephibosheth, from the mouth of shame. Goes from having a name of honor to having a name of dishonor. So that's what we know about Mephibosheth as we enter chapter 9. And it starts this way, that David asked, "Is there still anyone left in the house of Saul to whom I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" And this verse is loaded with meaning. But being part of the 21st century, being a part of an American democracy, being pretty far disconnected from monarchies where a king would rule a nation, we don't understand just how countercultural this is. Because when he asks if there is anyone left of Saul's family, sort of the competitor for the kingship, is there anybody left from Saul's family to whom I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake? He's basically asking, in essence, is there anyone left in the enemy camp that I can love, to whom I can show some love? And he's not looking to replace the friendship that he had with Jonathan. He's looking for an enemy to love. Jonathan, son of Saul, was loyal to David, but there are still lots of people who are loyal to Saul. Saul, who did not like David. So there are Saul loyalists in the land. And any descendant of Saul was a potential king, sort of offering the possibility, however remote, that they themselves could restore the Saul monarchy. And yet David wants to invite a descendant of Saul into his home. So if he was doing this the right way, he would be asking, is there anyone out there from the previous king's descendants that I should consider a threat? And is there any threat in the house of Saul that I should, you know, exterminate? Get rid of. Instead, he says, is there anyone left, any descendants, any relatives of that family to whom I may show the kindness of God? So it goes from verse 1, to whom I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake, to verse 3, to whom I may show the kindness of God. And that word translated kindness in verse 1 and verse 3, and then again in verse 7 when he speaks directly to Mephibosheth, it's this Hebrew word chesed. Chesed. It's one of those deep Hebrew words that's almost impossible to translate into English because English is insufficient to capture all that this word is. It's the kind of word that seminarians encounter when they take Hebrew for the first time. And then we have classmates. We have a classmate named Wayne who named his daughter who was born in seminary. Her middle name is Chesed. Because it's this powerful word that captures God's goodness, God's kindness, and more often than not, it's translated as steadfast love. Steadfast love. It's a favorite word among the psalmists to convey God's characteristic relationship with us. So Psalm 25, be mindful of your mercy, O Lord, and of your steadfast love, your chesed, for they have been from of old. Or Psalm 51, have mercy on me, O God, according to your chesed, according to your abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions. The word occurs 125 times in the Psalms. It's a favorite word of the prophets to designate our most appropriate relationship with one another. So Micah 6:8, What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love chesed, and to walk humbly with your God?" And the story of David and Mephibosheth conveys these meanings. And indeed, the story itself is better than any definition. The story itself is better than any definition. Is there anyone remaining in the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God? That's the way he says it to Ziba, a servant from the house of Saul. A servant from this person with whom he had this massive contest. And when Ziba hears the king's question, he's got to be thinking, uh-oh, this is a trick. This is a trick so that he can go kill whoever's left from my former master's house. And Ziba says, "Yes, king, there remains a son of Jonathan, but he's crippled in both his feet." So yeah, there's a descendant, but he's crippled. So there's no threat. Can I stress that? There's no threat. And by implication, Ziba's also saying, if you really do want to show him kindness, you know, it's probably not worth it. He's crippled because back then, people with disabilities were treated even worse than they are now. They were treated as though they were cursed, as though they had a contagious disease, as though they were demon-possessed. They were ostracized, set aside as though they were worthless. So it's kind of this double whammy for him. He's the son of the enemy, and he's crippled. And it only gets worse because, let's not forget, the details that Ziba provides. First, that Mephibosheth's living in Lodabar. Not a pasture, not lush land, not good eating. Second, although his name was originally Meribaal, his name is now Mephibosheth, from the mouth of shame. So this guy lives with those that are down and out because he's down and out. So all told, this is Mephibosheth's condition, right? He's physically crippled. He's crippled by no fault of his own, right? His plight has been handed down to him from another. It was his sort of nanny nurse that dropped him while they were running and permanently injured his feet. No good hospitals and rehab back then. And he's from Lodabar, from outside the pasture, in need of real food. He's sort of a picture of shame, from the mouth of shame, is the way his name gets translated. And perhaps worst of all, he was destined to be close to the king. He's Saul's grandson. And yet, he's separated from the king. He's separated from the king. And if his condition is not an analogy for all of us in our condition, then I don't know what is. The way that the Bible records it, humanity was born into these royal conditions. Not to be separated from the king, but to be princes and princesses under the king, to have dominion over what was happening. But we lost some of that status, and instead we're all sons of Adam and daughters of Eve, banished from the garden, from the pasture, you might say. Our plight handed down to us by no fault of our own, and our original nature distorted from God's intended design. So we're like Mephibosheth, sort of spiritually crippled instead of physically crippled. And through it all, we're saddled with shame. We've got to put on these fig leaves, hide behind bushes, everything that Genesis 3 kind of frames as a result. And if we aren't living in denial, we know these things about ourselves. We know that left to our own devices, we are dead dogs, to use the words of Mephibosheth. Ostracized because of our condition, separated from the king. And yet, what comes next in the text and what we've already uncovered during this service is that this passage is not just the story of David and Mephibosheth, but the story of every one of us. And this story is a foreshadowing. It's a picture of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And some may say, Jesus isn't even on the scene yet. But I'm telling you, Jesus makes all sorts of appearances in the Old Testament, and you just got to look for him. This is a prefiguration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's a picture of God's love for us, his chesed. And in order to see it, you got to understand that our condition is the same as Mephibosheth, the crippling, the shame, the separation from the king. And then comes the good news, the gospel, that even though our condition is similar to Mephibosheth's, our experience can be his as well. So that's what his condition is, but we're about to see what his experience is, that the king should banish him, but instead shows him mercy, that he's in no way worthy, and yet he's accepted, that he's welcome at the king's table, not by his own merit, but by the merit of another. His experience is the experience of the good news. His experience is an act of chesed. So yeah, we went up to like 30,000 feet to make those observations. Now I'll get back into the text at verse 5, when David sends for Mephibosheth. To me, this is the first act of chesed in the way this story goes. The king initiates, the king reaches out. Mephibosheth doesn't have to do anything or earn anything or even be on the lookout for the king. The king is searching for him. And the same goes for us, that as we come into this life, as the famous poem by Francis Thompson says, the hound of heaven is chasing us down, even while we're running away from the king, or even as we're banished to our own little Lodabars. The king of heaven is chasing us down. So Mephibosheth is sent for, and so he appears, and he does obeisance. And what a beautiful picture when he comes before the king and owns up to his own condition. He falls on his face before the king. And I'm not sure how he did that since he was already crippled in both feet. But however he did it, we would do well to emulate that posture before the Almighty King, to have that sense of, have mercy on me. Have mercy on me. And the response from the king is even more wonderful. Isn't it that after he falls on his face and does obeisance, David says, Mephibosheth. He calls him by name. He doesn't respond with, hey, that's right, I'm king now, you're my slave, serve me. He calls him by name, wanting to almost lift his head. Mephibosheth. He speaks his name and recognizes him as a person, which undoubtedly he was not recognized as a person in some other settings. And if there were any shame or dishonor associated with that name over the years, there is now no longer. The king has addressed him in this loyal, royal love. Mephibosheth. This is a picture of the gospel, that God does the same thing with us. God doesn't see each one of us as nameless servants. He doesn't see us as worthless and unworthy of being called by name and being viewed as people. He calls each one of us by name. He says, Bill, Kathy, Bob. And at some point, every single one of us hears God calling our name. Don't we? Mephibosheth has every reason to be deathly afraid of David at that moment. He has no reason to think that David is not out to get him, right? And yet the king utters these words of reassurance. First, Mephibosheth, and then, do not be afraid. Mephibosheth, do not be afraid. A phrase that's common to the biblical narrative. If you've read the Bible at all, you've seen this phrase many times, many times. It's a phrase on the lips of angels, the emissaries of God's news, whenever they show up. Do not be afraid. It's a phrase on the lips of Jesus, who regularly brought frightened and bewildered men and women into the very presence of God. Let me say that again. It was often on the lips of Jesus who regularly brought frightened and bewildered men and women into the very presence of God. And here it is on David's lips. David, who could have killed Mephibosheth, and protocol for the day was to do just that, to kill any descendants of the previous king. And David could have ostracized him, just sort of let the cripple live down and out in Lodabar, but he doesn't do either. Instead, he offers him a seat at the table. What a beautiful picture of grace, because to receive grace is to receive what we do not deserve. To get a seat at the king's table despite our condition. And sort of an added beauty to this whole story is that all of us can relate. We've all received meals by the sheer grace of another, whether we're invited into their home or wherever we happen to be. I think of one particular time in my life when I was making a trek across the country in between the first year of seminary and the second year of seminary. Driven across the country and was driving down to Tijuana to serve in Tijuana for the summer. And I had camped out the night before in the Sierra Nevadas and sort of come down the mountains into the lower central valley of California and was looking for a place to have breakfast. Hadn't shaved in a couple days, was just camping, kind of grungy, and drove past this place, the Olive Tree, and sat down at a counter. It was like a U-shaped counter. There's lots of seating over here, but like a U-shaped counter. And I sat down at the counter, and the waitress behind the counter that was helping people at the counter engaged me in conversation, found out I was in the middle of seminary. I was going to serve over the summer in Tijuana. And she said, "Oh, yeah, really? My boss is a Christian. There he is right over there." And there was a guy on the other side of the U, and he was reading his Bible at that moment. And had a little conversation with him, ate the rest of my breakfast, and which was, you know, after you've been camping, man, go down there and have some greasy eggs and bacon. There's nothing better. And then I was ready to leave, and I said, "Hey, I'll take the check." And she said, "Don't worry about it. He took care of it." And I said, "Come on, man, I got to do something for you. I can't get this for free." And he said, "No, there's nothing you can do. It's taken care of. Consider it a gift." Right? And just like so many of those other times when we're welcomed at some table, all I could do was receive it. Receive something that I didn't deserve, right? I was grungy as a little unkept dog. Facing the same question Mephibosheth faced, facing the same question you're facing today. Here's a free spot at the table. Your only possible response is to receive it. And it's kind of funny, when I was driving down through this valley and trying to find a place to eat, that I pretty much drove right by this restaurant. And I was about 2 miles past it before I thought, no, I think that might have been the place I wanted to stop for breakfast. I was looking for like a greasy spoon, not some chain, you know. And it seems to me that that's a parallel for what we might encounter, that you could just drive by this table of grace that's set before you. This gift that's freely offered. And it's like, don't drive by. Come by, be fed here. Here's Christ's blood shed for you. Here's Christ's body broken for you. No more separation from the King. Will you receive this free gift? And what does Mephibosheth do? Well, he receives it, right? What is your servant that you should look upon a dead dog such as I? He knows it's only by the kindness of the king that he is welcome at the king's table. It's only by the grace of God that we're welcomed in the kingdom of God. This is the way Ephesians 2:8 says it. "For by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not your own doing. It is the gift of God, that we're brought into proper relationship with the king because of not of anything that we could do, that would sort of take out God's role in it at all. Lots of people talk as though their eternal security rests upon them being a good person. You know, I'm a good person. I haven't done this or I haven't done that. So God will accept me. And that's like saying to God, you should let me come and sit at the table of the king because I'm so good. I'm such a good person. Which inherently takes God's role right out of it. That if that was the case, Jesus died for nothing. If that was the case, then what we do at this table is a waste of time. Because we'd have no need for God. We would practically be God. But none of us are God. Our resume of good deeds can't measure all the way up. Compared to some people, maybe. But compared to God, no, that your resume looks awful compared to Christ's. That's why, yeah, in Titus 3:5, it says this, he saved us not because of the righteous things we have done, because of our resume, but according to his mercy, his grace, his hesed. And I like that in this story, David makes no mention of Mephibosheth's, you know, lineage, his accomplishments. I mean, he's part of this lineage that he's has this right to the king's table if the king provides this mercy the same way back in Genesis. But he makes no mention of Mephibosheth's crippled nature. David sees him in a certain kind of light. He looks at Mephibosheth and he sees Jonathan. Mephibosheth gets a spot at the table not based on what he's done, but on the merits of another. Which is exactly the way God looks at us. When the king looks at us, he sees Jesus. You and I get a spot at the table, not because of what we've done, but on the merits of another. That's the gospel story. That's the story of grace. That's the story of God's hesed. He so desires to be in relationship with us that he provided the way and the means that we didn't have to. And only by that grace. The story of our condition is then overwhelmed by that experience, just like Mephibosheth's condition is overwhelmed by his experience. And verse 11 says that Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. So he hadn't done anything to be treated as one of the king, sons of the king. But he's brought there by the kindness of the king, the hesed of God. And only by that grace could he have a seat at the table. But the cool part is, not only does he get to enjoy that one time, he gets to be there always. Always. So hopefully you see why we might preach this text in a series about the Lord's Supper. That when Jesus was sitting around having that last supper with his disciples, was he thinking about David and Mephibosheth and talking about that? Probably not. But how could you not draw the parallel? How could you not draw the parallel? And check out verse 13. This is the third time in this brief little section that it says that Mephibosheth is eating at the king's table. Just emphasizing it over and over and over again. And right after emphasizing it, the storyteller throws in, as if you didn't know it, let me just remind you. Now, he was lame in both his feet. Like, don't miss the point of this story. That even those who feel most unworthy, and as Jim's prayer said, even those of us who want to guard other people from being worthy enough, that the king gets to set the worthiness quotient, that there is no worthiness exam at this table because he alone is worthy and was worthy on our behalf. Spiritually, you and I are crippled. We're in Lodabar. But we don't have to live separated from the king. The king is calling you home, calling you by name even, calling you to a meal, always at his table, a table of abundant mercy.